In the matter of Fred Krug versus New Jersey State Parole Board, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Assistant Deputy Public Defender Kevin Tankino, on behalf of the 5th Press Room.
Good morning, Jacqueline Dominguez from Greenberg Torrey, on behalf of the ACLU of New Jersey.
Morning, Your Honors. Christopher Ioannou, Deputy Attorney General for the State Parole Board.
I have the ACLU arguing before the ACDL. Have you switched? You can stay where you are. Stay where you are, then we'll keep the lineup as is. And we'll begin with Mr. Finkenauer. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
For the past 30 years, ever since Mr. Krug has been parole eligible, his parole has been governed by the standards set forth by the 1979 Parole Act. That act completely repealed the pre-existing 1948 Parole Act and created a new framework that by its express terms was to be applied to all existing New Jersey inmates. Under that act, the board was not permitted to consider information predating a potential parolee's most recent hearing after initial denial, thus excluding consideration of criminal history and prior infraction history at subsequent parole hearings. In 1997, as part of a broader wave of tough on crime changes to the Parole Act, that limitation was removed, allowing the board to consider any and all relevant information at subsequent parole hearings. Although similar punitive amendments to the 79 Act were not applied retroactively, the board made an exception for this one. Now, people whose offenses predate that act are having a parole standard applied for subsequent hearings that is much more onerous than the prior existing law. But both the state and federal constitutional protections against ex post facto laws are designed to prevent exactly this. Retroactive laws that have an enhanced punitive effect on a person's sentence. The significant 97 amendment retroactively permitting much greater latitude to deny parole must necessarily falls within this principle. In Mr. Krug's case in particular, it was evident that the consideration of his criminal history and prior infraction history had a substantial impact on his denial. In discussing those issues today, I wanted to first start by addressing the novel argument raised in the board supplemental brief about why Mr. Krug specifically cannot raise this argument because his offenses predate the 79 Act. And then after addressing that, I'll move on to discussing the substance of the issues that I briefed in my supplemental brief. So the ex post facto argument raised by Mr. Krug here applies to roughly 500 or so inmates who have offenses that predate the 1997 Act. The board's counter argument applies to roughly 15 inmates who have offenses that predate the 1979 Parole Act. Before addressing that on the merits, I did want to say again that this is something that wasn't raised at any point prior in the proceedings. Nor in Holmes, nor Trantino, nor other cases where this issue has come up involving 2A inmates. I think that creating a novel limitation on the ex post facto clause that will put us in conflict with the Third Circuit is something that should be avoided if the court doesn't have to do that. And I think it does not have to get into this argument in the opinion if it does not want to. Addressing the argument on the merits, before that, I did want to address another point before the merits, which is that as far as I can tell, we don't know specifically what the law was at the time of offense, which is September 1st, 1973. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So we have the text of the 1948 Parole Act, which was broadly what was in place before the 79 Act, but that act was amended a number of times. I reached out to the New Jersey State Law Library to try and see if I could get the copy of the law that existed at the time of offense. And all I was able to get was a version as amended through 1964. I did a similar OPR request with the board, but I also didn't have any updated statute with that respect. As to what's in the 48 Act in as amended through 64, it expressly only deals with initial hearings. It doesn't have anything that discusses subsequent hearings, which is what's at issue here. Presumably, the board did have some kind of protocol and rules about what to do at subsequent hearings, which would also be within the ambit of this argument. I tried to get those as well, and again, I had no success. My colleague from the ACDL was able to find some parole rules from the 40s and 50s. In my open request to the board, I was given a handbook that has regulations from 1978, but that's after the date of offense, and they expressly don't apply earlier. So again, we don't have the statute or the parole rules that were in place at the time of the offense.
As a general proposition, you agree that the date of the offense should be the operative ex post facto date?
I do not, Your Honor.
You do not.
I just wanted to start from the same place and before moving on to the merits of the argument. But I don't believe that the date of offense is necessarily the operative date for ex post facto, which I can begin addressing now. The whole impetus of the ex post facto clause is designed to prevent retroactive harm, to prevent a law that is applied retroactively that's enhancing someone's sentence. And I wanted to start with a factual example that I hope will kind of illustrate why I think this principle makes sense, irrespective of what the law was at the time of offense, and that's the abolition of the death penalty. We have people who are serving a sentence of life who had originally a sentence of death that was lower once the death penalty was abolished. Under the state's argument, if we were to bring back the death penalty, reinstate it, and it said that people who were originally sentenced should be placed back on death row, there is nothing in the ex post facto clause under their argument, or even due process, that would prevent that from happening.
That's not a realistic hypothetical. That's legislative determination.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's legislative determination that there's no death penalty.
Right. I mean, I think that could change. I probably wouldn't happen, but I think it is possible at all. But the point being that this is what the ex post facto clause is designed to prevent.
How do we know that that's what the ex post facto clause is designed to prevent versus that is generally unfair? So I'm referring to, for example, Calder versus Bull, 1798, U.S. Supreme Court, very soon after the time the ex post facto clause entered the Constitution, saying the prohibition on every law that changes the punishment and inflicts a greater punishment than the law annexed to the crime when committed. Or every U.S. Supreme Court case that I could find that was discussing the ex post facto law similarly said, assessing the risk of increased punishment relative to when the defendant's crimes were completed. The modern ex post facto analysis is concerned solely with whether a statute assigns more disadvantageous criminal or penal consequences to an act than did the law in place when the act occurred. I just couldn't find anything that attaches the ex post facto clause to any date other than when the act occurred. There might be a general due process argument that that's unfair, that once someone has benefits imposed on them after the crime is committed, it would be a due process violation to take those benefits away. But I couldn't find anything that attaches that to the ex post facto clause of either the federal or state constitution.
So there is language to that effect in numerous cases, but there is no case where that is part of the holding that it's necessarily a limit on the ex post facto clause. What has been stated time and time again, and what is an established interpretation of the ex post facto clause, is that it is a two-factor test. And I will quote from this court's decision in State versus Brown that I think sums this up best. Two findings must be made for a law to violate the prohibition on ex post facto. First, the court must determine whether the law is retrospective, meaning it applies to events occurring before its effective date. And two, the court must determine whether the law, as retrospectively applied, imposes additional punishment to an already completed crime. So there's just retroactivity and there's harm. It doesn't necessarily.
So in the portion, so in the already completed crime, that's where the date of the offense comes in. Wouldn't you agree? Because one of the central concerns of the ex post facto violations is the lack of fair notice in increasing punishment beyond that which was expected at the time the offense was committed, the time the punishment was imposed. So it
can, Your Honor, and there are times where that is appropriate, but the operative notice and expectation and reliance here is what the inmates have been told the law applies to them for the past 30, 40, 50 years. I don't think that it makes more sense for someone whose offense has occurred immediately before the effective date of the 97 amendments to be able to fall within this argument. But someone, again, for decades and decades and decades has been told, this is the act within which you fall, is then told that they don't. And again,
when was his second parole hearing?
I am not positive. I know he had one around 95-ish. I am not positive if that is his first or his second.
I had previous dates as November 3rd, 1994, March 6th, 2012, May 23rd, 2016.
That sounds like it could be correct.
You mentioned, and you know, obviously leaving aside the issue of whether this was properly raised before the court, but if you mentioned the difficulty that you had with great diligence in finding out what the rules were at the time of the offense. If we were to conclude, if we were to consider this issue A, and B, were to conclude that the date of the offense is the operative date for purposes of ex post facto analysis, should we even consider the difficulty of ascertaining what the rules were, which you cite, as a reason to somehow change the date because it's too difficult to figure out?
No, I don't think that's necessarily a reason to have a different interpretation of the law. I think it is something that weighs against wading into this argument at all, but it's not something that is dispositive as to why I think that the board's argument is wrong.
If we were to conclude that we've got to figure out the date of the offense is what's the appropriate date for purposes of this constitutional analysis, The difficulty with ascertaining exactly what the playing field was at that time, that's not part of the analysis, is it?
Not in part of a traditional ex post facto analysis, I wouldn't say. Again, I just think it is a practical complication that is one more reason why probably the argument should not be waded into.
Is there any reason to think that the new information versus no new information problem that we are addressing here was part of the 1948 Act, even with its amendments?
So it's hard. My answer would just be speculation, and it's not more than that. But I think there is good reason to think that probably they didn't really focus on old information at subsequent hearings under the 48 Act. You saw the board much, much more frequently under the 48 Act. The maximum time between hearings was a year, and often it was more often than that. So I find it very unlikely that they were relitigating your entire life every single time you sat before the board. And I think that the existence of this limitation in the 79 statute at least raises the possibility that it was codifying something that they were doing under the 48 Act. But I don't know for sure.
Again, wasn't the 79 Act expressly made applicable to all currently incarcerated people as of 79?
That's correct, yeah. People who were actively in prison, even if they were sentenced earlier, that act was expressly applied to them. And I think it's also worth noting that when inmates tried to raise ex post facto arguments against this new act and try to invoke the protections of the 1948 Act, that was rejected. And they were told, no, this is the act that applies to you. That's what they were told by the courts. That's what they were told by the board. And that's how they've been treated for the past 40, 50 years. And I think that...
Are you saying, I thought that the 1979 Act had put restrictions or had made it more likely that someone would be granted parole? Are you saying, and then the 1997 Act is the one that made it less likely that someone would be granted parole? Are you saying it's the opposite and the 1979 Act was restricting parole?
I am not making any interpretation versus the 48 Act and the 79 Act, really. Other than it was intended to create a more objective manner of conducting parole hearings. But as to whether it was easier under 48 or 79, I couldn't really say.
Okay. Justice Pierre-Louis mentioned that the central concern of the ex post facto clause being the lack of fair notice and governmental restraint when the legislature increases punishment beyond what was prescribed when the crime was consummated. And I think the way that that's discussed in US Supreme Court case law, at least, is the lack of fair notice being that in theory, perhaps someone has an expectation at the crime, at the time of the crime, what they can possibly be, what a sentence could possibly be, and to change that for the worse after the fact violates the ex post facto clause. That's specifically what the clause is trying to get at. If you don't understand that to be the purpose of the clause, then what is the purpose of the clause? How is it different from a due process clause, which would otherwise reach claims of unfairness of the type that you're making?
So that is absolutely one of the main impulses of the clause, but it's not, there's not this hard limitation on the clause in the way that the board is suggesting. And I would just point to language in cases that say, even irrespective of notice issues, when those don't apply, there is still unfairness when the state changes the rules by which it deprives someone or life or liberty. And that is the more broader fundament of the ex post facto clause, is retroactive changes that harm someone's punitive circumstances. And that's
what we have. Do you have any examples of that being tethered to a date other than the date of the offense?
So going back to why, how this argument is really being extrapolated from dicta, you'll also often see within the same breath, they'll say all relevant dates or also the date of the sentence, because again, that's not a hard line rule. And there is a case that's discussed at length in this court's decision, State versus Hester, which is an ex post facto case dealing with enhanced CSL violations, but it discusses at length this case called Greenfield versus Scafati, which is a federal case, and they use the date of the sentence as the...
The sentence in this case took place, he was sentenced when?
1975. My point is only that it's not, if the date of the offense is what's operative, then why are we even discussing date of sentence, or why is that ever the operative date? Because you don't really have that fine hardline rule. If anything, the courts have rejected
But what act was in place when he was sentenced?
It was the 79 Act was not passed yet.
Right. So that does the sentence versus the offense make any difference to your argument?
Not that specifically, but it goes to the point of the date of offense not necessarily being operative, because if we're talking about date of sentence, then that hardline rule can't exist because it would be immaterial under any circumstances.
Let me ask a slightly different question then. Do you have any case where the date, where the relevant date for purposes of the ex post facto clauses is anything other than the period during which the individual committed the offense and then was sentenced, which in most cases, not all, is usually within a relatively short period?
Is there an ex post facto case dealing with a law that was passed after sentencing? Is that the
question? A good way, better way than I came up with. So answer that one. Is there anything there? Because I think what you're suggesting is that we adopt somewhere in that period in which the 1979 Act was in place as the operative date. And I'm just having difficulty figuring out where does that come from in terms of the ex post facto world?
So I have a twofold response. One is that Holmes versus Christie expressly says that 2A inmates can raise this argument. The way it squares the circle is saying that this limitation preceded the 79 Act rather than saying it doesn't matter what the law in place was at the time of offense. But that is a case that expressly says that Mr. Krug can raise this argument. And the counter argument that that's not the case is not founded on anything concrete, because again, they can't establish what the law specifically was at the time of offense. But the other thing I'll say is that going back to the two-prong test, it's not some radical extrapolation of the ex post facto clause. It's something that falls very squarely within the two-prong test that time and time and time again has been used as the critical component of the ex post facto analysis. Is the law being applied retroactively? And is there punitive harm to the person? And as long as those two elements are met, then you have an ex post facto violation.
And you don't see any relationship between that first prong and the date of the offense?
Well, the date of offense, sorry. So the date of offense matters in as much as it preceded the law that's complained of, but you don't have to necessarily compare the new law specifically against the law in place at the time of offense, so long as the retroactive application is having a substantial punitive effect on the person who's complaining of the new law.
And that would apply all the time. So let's say the legislature amended a statute in a year that made it for people who are currently incarcerated. They got some sort of benefit from it. And then they decided, actually, this was a terrible idea. 6 months later, they amended again. And they say, you know, we're going back to how it was before. Then you're making an ex post facto argument every time because there's a retroactive effect when the legislature has amended the law, even if it you're still a lot better off than you were at the time the crime was committed?
It depends on the circumstances, but yes. And again, I would just revert to the death penalty hypo, which I recognize is the most extreme example of enhancing a sentence. But I think that that is correct, that that is what it was designed to prevent. And then going back to Calder versus Bull.
I'm not sure your death penalty hypo works for this reason. Weren't all of those sentences commuted? Weren't in effect? Weren't those individuals given a different sentence after the death penalty was abolished?
Right. I mean, the point is that it had a negative effect on their sentence. I think commutation of sentence or taking away credits or changing parole standards, you're still just within a punitive harm. It's a different kind, but it's still within the same harm as contemplated by the ex post facto clause.
If we conclude that the 1948 Act is the baseline, and we also conclude that there was no limitation on the parole board under the 1948 Act to what it could consider when determining parole, would you agree with me then that your client was not facing a prolongation of incarceration because the board considered more than new information?
My argument is that he is facing prolonged incarceration because of the application of the new law.
I understand, but my point is if the 48 Act applies, and if we conclude that there was no limitation on what the board could consider under the 1948 Act, just like there was no limitation under the 1997 amendment to the 1979 Act, then would you agree with me that your client would not face a prolonged period of incarceration because the board was permitted to consider under the 48 Act everything?
I would not agree with that.
Why?
Because again, the 1979 Act has been the act governing his parole proceedings for
set that aside for a minute. I said hypothetically, if we conclude that the 48 Act is the baseline, and if we also conclude that under the 48 Act, there's no limitation on what the board can consider, just like there is no limitation under the 1997 amendment to the 1979 Act, would you agree with me that for ex post facto considerations, your client, the inmate, was not facing any prolonged period of incarceration because the board could consider everything?
I mean, I maintain my original answer, but I guess I would say that I would agree that if there was no limitation in the 48 Act and no limitation in 97, that that is not worse.
Right. Well, and it is the case that under the 1997 Act, there is no limitation, right?
We don't know specifically.
I thought under the 1997.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misheard.
Yes.
Under the 97 Act?
Correct.
Right. That limitation was removed.
Right.
Then it is something of a piecemeal, because the board is still broadly applying that subsection to subsequent parole hearings. They have just kind of struck out the singular word new in the way that they conduct the hearings, but it's still broadly governed within that 79 subsection.
Right. Just to be clear, my question pertained to acts that were committed before 1979, like here in 1973, not inmates who committed acts between 1979 in 1997. I'm talking about a small sliver of inmates who committed acts before the 1979 Act became effective, who might very well be subject to the 1948 no limitation on what the board could consider factor.
Correct. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm starting to get a little.
I know. It's very complicated.
Just to clarify, you said that's 15 people total, correct?
Right.
Correct. So, and just to explain, just again, so everything is on the table, but I did an open request for inmates who were sentenced before 79. I was given 18 names. Of those 18, one is LWOP, one is out of state, and one I couldn't pull up in the system So I say 15.
Okay.
It's possible that that excludes a couple of stragglers who maybe their offense was committed. You know, that the sentencing, again, because what I used was a sentencing date. So maybe there are people whose offense date aligns with that that aren't considered, but it would be at most a small.
And also, State versus Hester is completely different than this case. You would agree with me?
Right. The only reason I mentioned that is because it relies substantially on a case who did not use the date of offense as the baseline for ex post
facto. But used sentencing.
Correct.
But they did consider the predicate act date when determining whether a violation of parole supervision post-sentencing would violate ex post facto, right?
They compared a law that was enacted after sentencing against the law that was in place at the time of sentencing.
In the context of when the predicate act was performed. So it's a little different in this case.
Right. Well, I guess my point is just that if we're talking about the date of sentence, then already it can't just be some hardline rule about date of offense.
But I'm saying in State versus Hester, the date of the sentence mattered specifically to when that portion of the sentence imposed parole supervision for life. But for purposes of ex post facto considerations, the predicate act was very important, the date of the predicate act.
Right. And I don't want to misconstrue entirely. The date of offense is important here, but it is important only in relation to the date of the complained of act, that the law in place at time of offense is not dispositive in every situation, because again, there is no such hardline rule.
But even you said, go ahead.
Is it fair to say that in every, even though he was sentenced before the 79 amendment and the 48 act applied at that time, as far as his future parole, that was eviscerated by the 79 act, and is it, can we assume properly that every time he saw parole after that point, it was after 79, and that the 79 act controlled in every circumstance he saw parole between then and now?
That's correct, Your Honor. The entirety of his parole has been governed by the 79 act. The 1979 act expressly obliterated the 48 act, brought everyone who was currently serving a sentence within it.
Do you have any ex post facto case that says that what we look to is what was the sentencing risk at the time of the first parole hearing, as opposed to at the time of the offense? And you're indicating that in a couple of cases, perhaps sentencing.
I would just point to Holmes being a completely on point case in terms of saying that someone like Mr. Crew could raise this argument.
But in terms of even the Third Circuit, I'm looking at Mickens Thomas. Even when they're explaining how the ex post facto clause is relevant to parole, it specifically says prisoners are entitled to know the range of punishments available at the time of sentencing and during the adjudication of their case so that they can plea bargain and strategize effectively. Therefore, an offender prior to his conviction and sentencing is entitled to know not only his maximum possible punishment, but also his or her chances of receiving early release, since this too is a relevant factor in the plea bargaining calculus. Therefore, a sentence that contained the right to parole consideration would give rise to a constitutional expectation that the parole guidelines extant at the time of the crime would be applied. So again, when they're talking even specifically about parole, the way the ex post facto clause intersects with parole is it is unfair to increase punishment that existed at the time of the crime, because people have to know how to plea bargain. It's fair notice. People have to know how they should be proceeding with their cases.
So again, that is part of it, but it is just, again, not the entire picture. And I would again point to someone whose offenses happened perhaps days before the enactment of the 1980 Act, the 1997 Act. That person is not looking at the parole regulations prior to committing their crime. It's kind of a fanciful notification issue. But when you have someone for 40 years has been told, this is your law, and they try to invoke the older law, and they're told, no, this is your law, that is a very real substantive notice expectation reliance issue that I think satisfies.
But that's not at the time, that's not at the time of either the crime or the sentence. There's no decision to be made the day for your client on the date that the who's already been committed his crime, been sentenced. 4 years later, I think it was, the law changes. there's no decision. He's made all of his decisions to the extent he made decisions before that change took place. So how could we move the date to the first parole hearing or the second parole hearing as the operative baseline?
So a couple of things. One is that there is still a lot of daylight between when someone becomes parole or when Mr. Krug became parole eligible and now, or when you're initially sentenced and when you start serving parole. If the parole rules changed, there are a lot of ways that impacts you, impacts perhaps the way you behave in prison. Might impact the classes you take.
No question impacts you, but
the arguments you make.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the ex post facto cases don't say if there is a change at any point in your entire sentence that makes it more or less, it makes your sentence potentially longer or shorter. That's not the analysis. The concept is tethered to the date of the offense and, you know, if to the extent the sentencing is talked about, it's considerations Justice Wiener after mentioned that plea bargaining may be at issue. But it would be fundamentally changing the analysis if we said, well, let's look at everything that happened in a very long history here, including his first and second parole hearings. That just doesn't seem to be part of the analysis in an ex post facto case.
So again, I'll just go back to, and I apologize for saying it again, but the analysis is two prongs, retroactivity and harm. And so that, again, it's not working outside of the ex post facto analysis. His argument falls very squarely within the parameters of what we have established for ex post facto. And the cases talk about notice and they talk about time of offense, but they also have language that says, well, even if those interests are not implicated, we don't care when you have these particular harms. So if they're saying, if the entire idea of the hardline rule that we have to compare against the date of offense is premised on an idea of notice, and the court is saying in cases, multiple cases, we don't always really care that much about notice, then it just doesn't make sense to have this bright hardline rule when that interest is not always 100% dispositive.
So if this is a fluid concept that changes over the entire period of incarceration of somebody, the state could have arguments that, well, no, we'll pick a different date. We'll pick his third parole hearing and say that that's the operative baseline and the law did not change after that. See what I'm saying? It just doesn't seem to be a basis in the law to start picking subsequent dates after the offense, after the sentence, to use as the baseline.
Well, I think there's too much hang up perhaps on the idea of the baseline, because again, the issue is retroactivity. If the law is being applied retroactively and it's harming the person, that's all we need. The baseline is just whatever the law was immediately preceding the new law in terms of ex post facto and whether or not it's harming a particular
person. We should look at any new law and say that the baseline is the day before that law went into effect, even if at that point the inmate's offense happened, has been sentenced, maybe pled guilty. That all happened before, but we should just say, what is it between the date before an amendment and the date after, no matter what connection that has with that particular inmate?
The baseline is the law actively governing the person sentenced right before they retroactively change the way it's being governed. And that, for Mr. Krug, for again decades, is the 1979 Act.
So I think I think we have your position on this point. Yeah. And since we're beyond the half hour, I wanted to move on. But Justice, if you wanted to touch on one more thing here, go ahead.
I'd like to try to keep this very short, and maybe this is to help my confusion. Isn't your answer to Justice Patterson's question that in this case, in 1979, the statute said we are going to capture and bring everybody into our benefits? So even though the conviction, the crime, the conviction, the sentencing all occurred pre-79, the 79 statute brings all of those people up to and applies a level of benefit to them. And that level of benefit then cannot be reduced in 97 by without infringing the ex post facto clause. Isn't that the answer?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's correct. I think that sums up my argument completely. So I will go over the remaining issues as quickly as I can.
Could the board deny parole in this case
on the basis of new information alone?
So I think, I mean, my opinion is no, but my argument is that that is not part of the analysis for what we look at when we're trying to assess whether or not there has been an ex post facto violation. Because again, the test is significant risk. And this is something that I think Holmes gets fairly right when it says that that's the significant risk test is incompatible with a but-for analysis, with trying to say, well, would he have been granted parole but for the old information? Because that's not the test. It's whether or not this old information posed a substantial risk or significant risk of resulting in a parole denial. And I think that the answer absolutely here is yes.
Even though the appellate division concluded that primary reason for denying parole was on the new information that the board had after the evaluation occurred.
I don't know that I read the appellate division's decision exactly that way. I think it considers the new information as a big part of the decision, but I don't think it interprets it as being the most significant. And if you look at it quantitatively, the old information is more significant, which is necessarily going to be the case when you've been parole eligible for 30 years and your crimes are 50 years old. But I think even substantively, his criminal history of, and I don't want to repeat it for my client, but rape, murder, assault, things like that are necessarily going to have a much heavier weight than a refusal to submit to a search that happened 3 years ago. So even substantively and qualitatively, this older information was certainly very harmful. And if you look at the board's decision in denying Mr. Krug's administrative appeal, they say, when he raises his argument, well, we looked at the record and you have all these crimes, you have all these infractions. And we think that based on that, a preponderance of the evidence at this time demonstrates a substantial likelihood of reoffense.
If you're correct and the 1979 Act should have applied and not the one that the parole board applied, should this go back for them to reconsider under the appropriate statute?
My requested remedy is a new hearing, which is something that, you know, he will receive in any event. But that's the remedy that I'm asking for, is a new hearing, not released. And I think that is the appropriate remedy in most ex post facto violations. That's not a reason to release someone on its own. And in that respect, just to discuss again a practical matter, I have a hard time seeing why the path forward would be anything other than discontinuing considering old information for people who are implicated by the ex post facto. Because in every single case, if a person raises the argument, the counter argument is always going to be, well, we didn't even need that information anyway to deny parole. And if that's the case, I just fail to understand why it would continue being considered and an issue at all, if it's not even dispositive to any of these denials.
The FTE here was 36 months, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So when would that be?
He has already had his next hearing. He was denied again.
So after the hearing that we're reviewing, there's been another hearing?
Correct, Your Honor.
And what did they consider in that hearing?
It was about the same.
Old and new?
Correct. I would say substantively very similar in terms of what the board's concerns were. The only thing I wanted to bring up briefly is Trantino 5 in the wake of Holmes. There hasn't been any counter argument made to this, but I feel like there's at least some kind of recognition now and consensus that that reasoning is wrong in terms of this statute being completely outside the ambit of ex post facto.
I'm sorry, I missed the end of what you said. Statute what?
Is not outside the ambit of ex post facto. Then it can be ex post facto if retroactively applied and poses a significant risk of hurting someone's sentence, which again, I submitted it here when you had,
you know. To clarify the standard from Trantino 5.
What Trantino 5 said was that this statute could not be an ex post facto violation if retroactively applied because it was procedural and not substantive.
That was a friendly question.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
yes, you want us to clarify? What Trantino 5 said.
Yes, sorry, I misheard. And unless Your Honor said any other questions, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkney.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mace.
Yes, may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of New Jersey. And rather than sticking to my plan, I'm gonna try to first address the questions Your Honors had about the timing of the offense, which candidly is a new issue, so it wasn't part of our briefing, but I think it's an important issue to address. And I don't think it's a question that this court needs to answer in sort of the formalistic way the question has been posed. And I think Justice Hoffman's question hits the nail on the head, which is that the statute, the 1979 statute itself addresses this and it applies. And I can point you to the provision. It's section 30:4-123.46. So by the very terms of the 1979 Act, the Act was extended to everyone convicted prior to 1979. So I don't think we need to get into this question of, is it 48 or is it 79? The statute brings within its protections everyone convicted prior to 1979.
Can that work the other way? Could the legislature say, knowing that it had made a sentence longer punishment more severe, can the legislature say, oh, by the way, everybody who was convicted at the time in X date before is now looped under this particular act?
In a way,
I think you would be saying that doesn't solve the ex post facto problem. See what I'm saying?
So are you saying in a way that harms people?
In a way that makes, so let's say the legislature did the opposite. But let's say the 1948 Act said only new information, and the legislature changed the Act in 1979 to say old and new information. Could the legislature then say, by the way, we're looping everybody who was previously convicted under this obscure 1948 Act that we're getting rid of? Everybody's now under this. I think you'd be arguing that doesn't solve the ex post facto problem, because when the offense was committed, it was under that old act.
I think because that type of rule would harm the prisoners that were convicted earlier. So I think that kind of recognizes that the way the 79 Act is written, it makes it, it's in a way more lenient for.
But what I'm saying is the argument is that the legislature, by saying all of these people with the old offenses will be, parole will be under the 1979 Act, mm-hmm. old and new. If that affects ex post facto, then that's a two-way street. See what I'm saying? They weren't talking about ex post facto when they said that, right?
I don't know for sure, but since we know how it operates, and we know that the 79 Act provides more protection, then in the future, then it doesn't. You know, applying the 79 Act retroactively doesn't raise those same.
But you see what I'm saying is that when the legislature says we're going to take all the current inmates and put them all under this new act, mm-hmm. if that eliminates any ex post facto problem for the state, mm-hmm. then that's the legislature changing the constitutional standard. See what I'm saying? In other words, when the legislature says we're going to have everybody under the same statute here, it doesn't eliminate an ex post facto problem that might exist in certain circumstances.
I'm struggling to come up with a broad answer to that. I think the question of, are we looking at the timing of the conviction or the timing of the sentence?
Maybe I should ask it a different way. Can the legislature dictate through its, mm-hmm. and it's not, obviously did not address ex post facto. Can the legislature, by announcing that inmates are all going to be considered under this parole process, change the baseline date from the date of offense or the date of sentencing to some later date by legislative act? You see what I'm saying?
Now I understand. I think yes, as long as it's not doing it in a way that disadvantages inmates. And I think the parole context here.
Okay, so let's say the legislature then says, okay, we've got our 1991 act and everybody's under that, right? All our current inmates should be under that.
Yeah, I mean.
Does that make the baseline 1991?
I think it does.
Okay. And that means that somebody who was sentenced under a prior parole law at the time of the existence of a prior parole law could lose protections.
No, I don't think it can. The legislature can do it in a way that removes protections. So maybe it's more of a case by case basis.
So where's the interpretation of the ex post facto clause by the U.S. Supreme Court that it applies? Doesn't matter when the crime was committed. If the legislature grants a benefit retroactively, it can never take that benefit away. Because I think that's what you are arguing.
My colleague always comes up with better questions than I do.
Disagree. But I think I understood that that's what you're arguing, that if the legislature grants a benefit retroactively, it can never take that away without violating the ex post facto clause. And so my question is, where do we find that in the case law about the ex post facto clause?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. So I think the Supreme Court cases on ex post facto clauses, on the ex post facto clause, are a little bit all over the place. Sometimes we're focusing on fair notice. Sometimes we're focusing on, did the legislature disadvantage a certain class of inmates? There are several concerns. I don't think fair notice is the pure sole concern. For instance, I was looking back at Garner versus Jones, which says the danger that legislatures might disfavor certain persons after the fact is present even in the parole context. And the court has stated that the ex post facto clause guards against such abuse. So I don't know if you're going to find a case that's, exactly in this context, but I don't think it should turn on such a formalistic question of a date. Especially because we see you could have date of the offense, you could have date of sentence. In this parole context, you have, first parole hearing and second parole hearing.
That's the essence, is where do you get the first parole hearing and the second parole hearing as baseline dates for ex post facto?
Well, it kind of turns back to what right or what consideration, what fairness concern are you thinking of? Are you thinking of fair notice? Are you thinking of...
I'm actually just looking for some tethered in the law for changing the baseline date from offense-sentence to parole hearings that may take place over the course of years and years and maybe under law that goes in different directions. And if your answer is anything that helps the defendant goes, I don't see that in the ex post facto law.
Well, for starters, I don't think this is a question that the court needs to answer in this case.
Understood.
Okay.
But you've noted it's an important question.
Yes.
Counselor, so, might the answer to Justice Patterson's question be either Weaver versus Graham or Daubert? So for instance, when Weaver versus Graham in 1981 says, relief under the ex post facto clause is not the right to less punishment, but the lack of fair notice and government restraint when the legislature increases punishment beyond what was prescribed when the crime was consummated. Thus, it violates the clause if the new law is both retroactive and more onerous than the law in effect on the date of the offense. Aren't those cases the answer to Justice Patterson and Justice Wainwright's question?
I agree. I think so.
But they all mention on the date of the offense.
They do. That's because of the context in which those cases were raised. We have a unique set of circumstances here where we have the 1979 Act, which applies to, by its very terms, applies the act to prior, lumps in all prior inmates under the 1979 Act.
And so does the 1991 Act, right?
I don't know off the top of my head, but, if that's the case, you have to look at it the same way. And I think that's why courts that have addressed this question haven't grappled with this issue, because the most protective and the way you can honor the ex post facto clause in this setting is to apply it to the inmates.
Is it really whenever we find an event that if it helps the inmate, we can use a later event? And I'm just wondering if the reason why courts haven't grappled with this is that the cases start from the premise that you're looking at the different, that a first date and a later date, and the first date is tied in with the offense or sentencing.
The courts haven't, I don't think they have grappled with that question. They haven't, you know, come to a conclusion. Like, for example, Accoli, Holmes, Trantino, all three of those cases involved inmates that were convicted or committed a crime prior to 1979.
But there was no ex post facto challenging Accoli.
The court didn't discuss it.
It was not raised by the inmate.
Right, but the court still applied the 1979 Act.
Wasn't in dispute. What was in dispute was whether the determination by the full board was arbitrary and capricious.
Yeah, it actually wasn't in dispute. I don't think it was in dispute in this case either until we came here. But I think when you go back to what is the court and what is the ex post facto clause designed to do, it's designed to prevent the legislature from disadvantaging a certain class of inmate. And that's what's happening here. So I would say rather than focusing on the exact triggering date, you look at the effect of what the application of that rule is achieving.
I'd just like to add one more sentence to what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Weaver, following up on what Justice Hoffman was pointing to. The ex post facto prohibition forbids the Congress and the states to enact any law, quote, which imposes punishment for an act which was not punishable, here's the important language, at the time it was committed, semicolon, or imposes additional punishment to that then prescribed. So back to the point that Justice Patterson has been making all along, it really goes back to when the act itself was committed.
I think
that's consistent with what the 1997 amendment to the 1979 Parole Act imposes.
That definition is easy to apply when you're talking about a new law or a change in sentencing. Here we have a different context, which is the parole context. And we know that the Supreme Court has applied ex post facto clause to the parole context. We happen to find ourselves in a situation where the date of conviction or the date of sentence doesn't fit neatly into our analysis. So then I think we need to look a little bit broader and see what else matters in terms of fair notice.
What do you mean by it doesn't fit neatly into our analysis?
Because the change that's happening here affects the inmate in between the first and second parole hearings. So, it's not the same thing as someone was convicted of a crime that wasn't a crime, on the date he committed it.
But your adversary says that defeats the ex post facto argument because that baseline date is pre-79.
If you think of that date as the only thing that matters in terms of fair notice, and I'm suggesting that's not the only date that matters in terms of fair notice.
What's the notice argument that applies to a change between one parole hearing and the next?
So, there's, if your behavior between a first and second hearing could change based on your understanding of the law. There's,
meaning what? Because that's going to be new information no matter what. If you're talking about disciplinary infractions,
yeah,
that's going to be if the operative date is the first parole hearing and the change is the second parole hearing. Either way, disciplinary infractions are going to be coming into play.
Yes, but it could just affect the way a prisoner is thinking about, their chances for parole.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Not on that topic, I don't think.
We're beyond 15 minutes now, so if you have another point, I'd just ask you to make it.
I just want to get back to what really brought, I think, brought us here.
And if you could, let's try to do that.
And that is just that the Trantino distinction between procedural and substantive is no longer good law as recognized in Holmes. And
you want us to address that as well?
Yes.
Okay, understood.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Kilmore.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, and may it please the court. I know this has already been a long argument, so I will keep my comments very brief. And I have two main points to raise. First, although the ACDL would agree with our colleagues that all inmates who have committed their crimes prior to 1997 should be treated the same and the 1979 Act should be the baseline for them, this court should at least find that the 1997 amendments, as it relates to individuals who committed their crimes between 1979 and 1997, it would be an ex post facto violation to apply the new amendments as to them. And in so holding,
that would be partially an advisory opinion or dicta because it wouldn't be raised by the person who is actually before the court, correct?
Correct. But this issue was the issue that was raised down below. It was the only issue, realistically, the ex post facto issue that was addressed by the appellate division, which is how we got to Tarantino 5 in the appellate division's case. And of course, this remains an issue of great public importance. As my colleague from the OPD indicated, there are approximately 500 individuals who do fit within this category, and the Trantino 5 standard does run counter to very well-settled precedent by the Supreme Court. And the only other thing that I would add with respect to application of the 1948 Act, while I'm certainly not going to disagree with the language that is included in the Supreme Court opinions that, you know, all of you justices cited, that would apply in a typical case. And I think here we have something very far from a typical case. These were not just changes in the parole laws. They were prompted because between the 1948 Act and the 1979 Act, we had a complete change in the criminal code. We had 2A, we went over to 2C. And because of that, we were essentially in a different place procedurally, such that perhaps we can't consider this challenge under ex post facto alone. And we should also consider it ex post facto, perhaps with fundamental fairness, because
we have before us, counsel, an ex post facto challenge.
Yes, absolutely.
Of course, amicus are enormously valuable, but the amicus can't introduce a new claim that wasn't made by the inmate in this case.
Absolutely, I agree. I would just like to add for the court that, you know, part of the reason why we are here is based on the position that the parole board has taken, not just in proceedings in this case, but in proceedings in multiple cases over the past several decades. And one of the biggest problems with not having a full record regarding not just what the 1948 Act says in its entirety, but also how it's applied is really a matter of the own making of the parole board, insofar as they have consistently treated individuals who committed their crimes prior to 1997 the same. And so we know from the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Garner, we know from the Third Circuit's opinion in Holmes, that really whether or not there's an ex post facto violation is a matter of degree, and how the 1948 Act in this case was applied to individuals like Mr. Krug. And on this record, we simply don't have the record to make that assessment.
I'm not sure the parole board's responsible. There are a number of areas of law where it's very hard to find the history of changes in a regulation, changes in court rules. That's not on any party, as I would perceive it.
Well, I think it seems so. The substantive standard that is at issue here between the 1979 Act and the 1997 amendments, the substantive standards, you know, the language that the parole board has been applying, you know, they've been applying the more lenient standard for some aspects, but then they've taken out the new information, old information distinction, right? So it has been in the manner in which the parole board has taken positions in challenges like Mr. Krug's and other individuals. So my point is merely that on this record, it would be very difficult to determine that there was an ex post facto violation or whether there was not. And while that typically would be something that should be addressed by Mr. Krug or someone similarly situated, in this case, essentially the board should not be able to use the reasoning in Trantino 5 as a shield. And now that the issue is before this court, using the 1948 Act as a sword. So we would just encourage the court.
Using the 1948
Act as essentially a sword to a constitutional violation.
But the board does seem to concede that there is no procedural, substantive, rules. So to the extent that Trentino 5, and I'm not sure that it's fair to say that Trentino 5 said it was, you know, ignoring whether it's a risk of increased punishment and instead creating a new rule that's procedure versus substance. But the board agrees with you to the extent Trentino 5 did do that and created this new rule where we ignore a substantial risk of increased punishment. And instead, all we talk about is procedure versus substance. That is not good law.
Correct. That's it. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you, Counsel.